This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. A far-reaching amnesty bill tabled by the Thai government last month triggered mass opposition-led demonstrations as it would give former Premier Thaksin Shinawat a clean slate from his corruption charges and pave the way for his return from self-exile. The Yingluck Shinawat government, headed by Thaksin's younger sister, has since backed down from the bill and called for snap elections next February after the mass resignations of all opposition lawmakers in an attempt to curb the political turmoil. Where does Thailand go from here? We speak to political scientist Dr. Joel Moore to find out. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Moore, before we start, what gave rise to your interest in Thailand?
So, I actually spent a year in Thailand as an exchange student when I was in high school. And it was a really tremendous experience. I really fell in love with the people, made fast friends, and became really fascinated with the political structure. When I was there, it was just after the coup in the early 90s, and trying to reconcile what I observed of people and their attitude toward each other, toward the government, and these sporadic incidents of conflict. It's really fascinating.
And, you know, Thailand's been in, I guess, they've been making the news a lot in the past couple of years now for lots of different reasons. But for this latest round of protests, what led up to it and who are the stakeholders involved?
So as you mentioned, the most recent catalyst has been this amnesty bill by former Prime Minister Thaksin's sister, who is now Prime Minister, Yingluck Shinawat. So once the amnesty was put forward, it really sparked the most current wave of protests. And these protests have fed into a couple of narratives that have gone throughout similar sorts of protests in the past. So within Thai society, there are a couple different groups that have a really dominant narrative in how they understand political events and how they understand their relationship with democracy. So on the one hand, you have particularly the urban middle class. So for them, the story is about good governance versus corruption. So democracy is great in that it provides leaders who are enlightened, have the benefit of the nation at heart, and will be not self-interested once in office. So as to their favoritism toward democracy, it's been somewhat ambivalent. So in the coup in the early 90s, initially they welcomed the coup makers in the streets and in the military. Finally, they saved us from these corrupt politicians. A very similar thing happened in the 2006 coup. I was there. People were handing roses to the soldiers. They were very happy in Bangkok. So that's one narrative, this idea that the ideal form of government, maybe it can be provided by democracy, maybe not, but really it should be these enlightened, non-self-interested actors. And the second is the rural poor. Okay, so farmers, people in particular in the north and the northeastern part of Thailand. So there it's a transition from viewing themselves as subjects of the state to citizens. And before 2000, before Thaksin, before the most recent constitution, more or less their interaction with government were these elections under an electoral system that didn't really give them much voice. They had the ability to choose between sort of local godfathers, local political machines, who would then use office to benefit themselves. So interaction with democracy, with government, wasn't really choosing their representatives so much as just selecting among which local power they would favor. Okay, so you have these two narratives. But over time, particularly after 2000, after Thaksin comes in, it becomes clear that for the first time, the government is offering a policy and a policy change that will potentially make their lives better. So the universal health care for a very low price, debt forgiveness for farmers, various entrepreneurial promotion at the local level. So they're seeing how being a citizen of a country, it will respond to their wishes, and so democracy can be a good thing. So these are two narratives that on the one hand, are very much different, but on the other, there's no necessary reason that they should be in opposition to one another. I mean, there's an overlap where there's potentially an elected government where corruption is kept to a minimum, they have the best interests of the nation at heart, and it benefits the rural poor.
Which is really an ideal government for any country,
absolutely.
You know. But when you're talking about those two narratives, is there one that has achieved, I guess, any particular dominance in the public sphere? Is there one that people are acceding to more and thinking, okay, that's the way that we should be going in?
I would say it depends very much on who you ask.
And where you are.
And where you are. And so these narratives that operate in amongst the people are to some degree being hijacked by those with power and those with the desire to have more power in the future, or at least not to lose the power that they have. So you hear a lot about former Prime Minister Thaksin and his desire to – that he was very corrupt and that he used his office to benefit himself and his family, and he was increasing his reach, declining the checks and balances, putting family members in the military. These were all true, and silencing opposition. These were certainly all true. And so on the one hand, Thaksin becomes the champion of the rural voters because he's really engaging them in the political process, but he's becomes the key villain in the other narrative. And that forwards – or that – to some extent, though, benefits those actors who traditionally have had more power in the center. So the really key families within Thailand, interlinked through marriage, with the key business interests, with the key political interests, and the military, the upper echelon of the military. So these traditional sources of power viewed Thaksin as a threat, and so they've moved this middle class versus corruption narrative to become a middle class versus Thaksin.
Yeah.
And willing to accept a certain amount of corruption if it gets Thaksin out. We saw that in the last election.
You mentioned the military there. How powerful is the military in this situation? And I suppose in general, is it second only to the monarchy?
Mm-hmm. So it's a great question. And to some degree, we don't know the answer because the military historically hasn't been a unified institution. Thailand's known for having countless coups, but a lot of those coups haven't been against elected civilian governments, but against other military governments. So there are bound to be very powerful factions in the military, and I think we can see this in political events as they unfold. So there's going to be disagreements, some of which more side with the Bangkok elite, some of which more side with Thaksin and his allies. And so undoubtedly there's behind the scenes competition, discussion, debate within the military about what to do next.
The army invited protest leader Suthap Thyoksuban to join the heads of the army, navy and air force at a seminar to find a way out for Thailand. Is this, you know, part of the army effectively sidelining the current government to speak to the protest leader in that fashion?
So as much as possible, I definitely believe that that's Suthap's goal. Is to create a situation where the military has sufficient justification to intervene,
yep.
Or the courts to intervene and nullify the elected government. And certainly there are factions within the military that would like to do that. So what I suspect is this is those factions trying to convince the other factions to get on board.
And, you know, when I asked you about the military earlier, I mentioned the monarchy because obviously Thailand and the Thai people are incredibly well known for loving their king. They're one of, I guess, the few countries I can think of that honestly adores their monarch. So do you think the king would get involved in the near future?
So that is another fantastic question and one that I don't have an informed opinion about. I could hazard a guess, but I don't think there would be much basis for making that guess. So one question that is of incredible importance in this story is the question of royal succession. So the king is has been on the throne for a tremendous amount of time, as you say, is well-beloved. And it's – although there is a framework in place to decide who takes over next, ostensibly the Crown Prince, there are a lot of question marks about this process and a lot of rumors. So Thailand is abundant with rumors, conspiracy theories. I think at some level there are groups behind the scenes who have vested interests in it playing out a certain way or another way, but those of us who aren't privy to that information really can't make an informed call.
So it's all rumors at this moment. It's all rumors and military discussions.
Well, there are some facts. I mean, we know there are power players. So Thaksin is a power player. He has tremendous support in the northeast, in the north. We have these factions within the military. You have the Democrat Party, which seems to command the continued loyalty of the Bangkok middle class in the south. And these are the players, and they are to some extent jockeying for position both now and whoever holds the reins of power when succession does occur potentially does have an advantage in determining the direction things go after that.
I'm speaking today to Dr. Joel Moore, political scientist from the Monash University Sunway campus. We're discussing political turmoil in Thailand. Coming up, we find out more about what might be stopping the government from authorizing force to deal with protesters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me, Dr. Joel Moore, political scientist from Monash University Sunway campus, and we're discussing the political turmoil currently engulfing Thailand. So we've established who some of the stakeholders and power players are, as well as the situation that's led to the impasse we're at the moment. What's stopping the government from using force to deal with the protesters? I mean, it would seem in some countries in Southeast Asia, that always seems to be the government's prerogative.
Right. So the although this government has the mandate given to them by the majority of the population, as we've indicated, one of the real concerns is that the military could intervene or that the courts could intervene and nullify their place. So the protests, the formula for these protests as they have occurred is that you mobilize a large number of people, camp out in places, and then gradually escalate. And to some degree, it's intended to be provocative to cause the government, the elected government, to overreact, use force, use violence to stop the protests, which would then give the military a justification to intervene and take control so as to maintain stability in the country. So they're walking a very fine line between trying to maintain some degree of efficacy to show that they are potent, but on the other hand, not to provoke the military.
On the other side of the divide, though, protesters led by Suthep cut off electricity to the Prime Minister's office last week. So what's stopping mass demonstration from turning violent? I mean, never mind what the government's going to do, but when you're talking about large groups of people, you know, dealing with massive amounts of rage, mm-hmm. How do you keep that from, or what's stopping that from becoming something much worse?
So that, again, is a very good question. It has been an impressive effort on both sides to limit the degree to which violence has occurred. So police notably standing by, stepping back, allowing them to occupy government house. But that being said, when you get large numbers of people who are very emotionally charged on an issue like this, violence can and does occur. There have been a couple of skirmishes in Rom Kham Hang University and also, I believe, an incident where a policeman was injured for filming some protesters. And certainly as it continues, I think the danger that this will lead to violence will increase, especially if the registers themselves feel the need to mobilize in response to have a show of force or show of support. Having the two groups in the same place at the same time almost certainly would lead to unfortunate consequences.
Going back to what kicked this whole thing off, why was the amnesty bill even introduced? Was it a political miscalculation on Yingluck's part?
It seems to be, yeah.
Yep.
It seems to be, you know, it's always been clear that it was this government's intent to eventually bring former Prime Minister Thaksin back.
With that surname, it would have been impossible not
to
notice.
Right. Yeah. You can't sneak this one out of
no.
the table. I mean, what was really great about the reaction to the amnesty before Suthep really pushed everything in the direction that he did was that there was actually some protests from the rural poor, from the red shirts themselves, who didn't want to see amnesty for Abhisit and the Democrats for the crackdown that occurred in 2010, that they had become sufficiently mobilized with their own narrative that we're citizens, and even though, you know, you're our elected representatives, we're not your subjects, and, you know, we're going to stand up and say, this is going too far. You're serving your own interests and not the interests of us. And so that brief spark before it became hijacked by Suthep, and now it's kind of an us versus them story again.
Yeah. And what exactly was the content of the amnesty bill? I mean, surely it wasn't just, you know, aimed towards bring my brother back into the country.
Right. So there were. So it was the long struggle for the amnesty bill was trying to get both sides on board, which is to have enough in it that the Democrats in particular will sign off and allow those Tairak Thai people who especially Prime Minister Thaksin, who needed forgiveness from under the law in order to come back, and then for the Democrats to be cleared of any potential wrongdoing in the crackdown in 2010.
Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat has already called for fresh elections. Why are the protesters still unhappy? I mean, this call came, I would say, you know, relatively quickly considering how, you know, how everything went down. So what are people still pushing for?
Right. So again, the narrative that we discussed earlier in terms of the middle class versus corruption, they allege that elections in Thailand are to some degree illegitimate, and that particularly in rural areas, people buy votes, candidates, parties provide money to people in exchange for their vote, and therefore what we see in terms of the elected government is not really the will of the people. So from their point of view, having another election is just giving the Thaksin administration, the Shinawatra administration, the opportunity to corrupt the system again and to help itself at the expense of the people.
With that said, one demand for reform from the protesters is, ironically enough, to move away from the one-man, one-vote system, believing that the masses are not sufficiently educated to make an informed decision. How would the opposition benefit from this move? And how would that even work?
It's a great question. So the what has been offered is a continuation of something that was offered in the last round of protests, which is some degree of appointed people to represent the interests of particular professions, an administrative body that isn't directly elected and, importantly, aren't politicians. So this really, as a rhetorical device, jives with this narrative that we will get the best people who have the interests of the country at heart. They will represent these interests because they will know this profession or that profession.
They'll understand us and they'll understand mm-hmm. enough about the system
right.
to make the right choice.
Right.
Something like that?
Something like that.
Okay.
So, I mean, from my own point of view, I think that is doomed to failure. You know,
for many reasons.
Democracy isn't perfect, certainly, but it so far seems to be the less imperfect of various systems of government. And yeah, so this system is beyond being a rhetorical device and potentially a vessel with which to control the process of succession or to administer the country while that occurs and to see it through any potential imbalance that occurs during that process. From the point of view of the middle class, I think they'll see that the inevitable corruption that will occur as a result of this
of
sort
that
of
system yeah.
is going to be much worse than anything they've seen so far.
That would require utopia.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
to work. But that's true of any democracy. Yeah. What are the potential implications for democracy if an unelected leadership, albeit in a caretaker capacity, is appointed to run the country?
I think they'll be terrible. I mean, to the extent that people will see that it's impracticable and choose not to support it in the future. So we saw this in the 1990s. They supported the coup initially, but once it was clear that the general was going to stay in power as the prime minister, then there became the cell phone revolution or the mobile phone revolution, and the middle class rejected that. So, I mean, I think ultimately they would reject it in the medium term, but that's just more continued crisis, instability, uncertainty in the future.
Have populist policies enacted by Thaksin genuinely helped the poor, or did it amount to vote buying at the expense of taxpayers' money? I mean, we've been talking quite a lot about Thaksin and how he bought, I don't know if it's fair to say bought his way into power, but this was one of those ways.
Right. So it's a great question. So I think poverty has decreased quite substantially for the poor in particularly in those areas that had been neglected by previous governments, especially the Northeast. Poverty has gone down. Some of these programs have been, you know, in the lines of the state providing public goods like healthcare, these entrepreneurial funds, these one village, one product sorts of schemes. Have had some beneficial impact. But I'm sure a lot of it has been also calculated to enrich himself and to ensure his continued power. But these sorts of policies are policies which democracies are actually pretty good about, you know, debating and deciding. Well, we can set it at X level or X plus 1 or X plus 5. I mean, they're movable. They're things people can negotiate and debate and discuss. So there's nothing intrinsically wrong with having policies that are pro-poor, and you can fight that out within the context of a democracy.
Electoral fraud is a very heavy phrase, and it's one that is often discussed, especially with elections looming about. Is it pervasive in Thai politics, or has it been proven to be so, or is it merely charges that have been, you know, trumped up or perhaps exaggerated by the opposition?
So the historical legacy is that before the 1997 constitution, which brought Thaksin into power in 2001, was that these elections, the electoral system was quite different. And in order to become elected, members of parliament really needed to disperse these sorts of benefits to voters, so direct cash or throw elaborate parties, and the voters would have to see that candidate and vote for them over other people from the same party. The electoral change that came about with the 97 Constitution really changed that in a fundamental way. So it was much more in line of, this is my party, this is our platform, this is what we stand for, vote for us. So this description of vote buying is very, very relevant for this earlier period. For now, you know, you talk to these farmers and they're pretty savvy. I mean, they know they can take money from Party X and vote for Party Y. I mean, I don't think it's a question of education. And some recent studies, one by the Bangkok Post, about some smaller parties and some larger parties trying to make inroads in the Thai Rak Thai / Pheu Thai stronghold by vote buying. And they spent something like three times as much as the Pheu Thai in vote buying, and they weren't successful, which suggests that, yeah, this is just, you know, very small scale. The voters at this point are motivated more by policy than by these small amounts of money.
And one crucial, I guess, member or component of any such uprising or any such turmoil is the media. The media always plays a very important role in disseminating information and reporting things as they happen. What is the media environment like in Thailand? Is it free to to have honest critiques of what's going on and of all relevant parties?
There is a very, and has been historically, a very vigorous media in Thailand discussing many issues, politics in particular, with the exception of the royal family. And the laws that prevent that have over time gotten stronger, more strictly enforced. Charges can be brought against a person not just by the government, by other people, private citizens. And that has definitely had a tremendously chilling effect on discussions of what's going to happen. I mean, what's going to happen when the unfortunate happens and we have to start thinking about succession? And does that have anything to do with this current political story? The fact that you can't have a free and open discussion about that and people self-censor to a great degree definitely has the propensity to make this worse.
Thaksin Shinawat's premiership was the most distinct in Thailand's modern history, and his now defunct Thai Rak Thai Party dominated the country's politics for almost two decades, What went wrong, or rather, what went wrong for him to lose power? I think we can examine what was wrong with his leadership, pretty easily. But what caused is that loss, I suppose.
His loss, like what got, why did the coup occur? Okay, so the primary catalysts for the coup were, I think, one, that he was placing his people in key positions in the military, particularly his family members, which created a great deal of urgency. It has to be now because in the future we can't do it. And historically, anytime the civilian governments have intervened in the promotion in the military, it's tended to be perceived very badly by the military and has in some cases provoked coups. So that's one thing. So right before the coup, there was a speech by the head of the Privy Council, former general and former prime minister for 10 years himself, Prem, and he made comments alluding to that the military owes its allegiance to the king and not to the elected government, and they need to make decisions based on that. It was a not so subtle.
Yeah.
provocation for them to take action. So they definitely felt, the Privy Council and certain elites definitely saw former Prime Minister Thaksin as a threat, that he would continue to centralize power around himself. And I think that's true. I think he would have and silence opposition in a very, very straightforward kind of way.
As is, it's not as if he's been easy to get rid of.
Yeah.
So there's that. Moving back to the issue of media, apps have been created on smartphones to simulate whistles that protesters would blow at rallies, and various games pitting Thai political parties have topped the app charts. What is the role of technology and social media in a heightened political environment like this?
Yeah, it's worrying. I mean, I think that the tendency toward confirmation bias in the way people consume media, particularly social media and online news resources. I have my friends who have similar views. They share information, they share articles, or I go to news sites that cater to positions that I already hold, and they find evidence that supports my worldview. It makes dialogue and compromise, civil discourse, much more difficult, I think. And I think that not only in Thailand but everywhere in the world, this is something we have to wrestle with.
On the other hand, social media played a crucial role in the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. And are there any dangers, or is there any likelihood, I guess, of this spilling over into the rest of the region in that same way?
My hunch is that Thailand's situation is very peculiar to Thailand. I think there is the potential that the kind of nationalism that the anti-Thaksin folks have shown in the past has split over into other arenas, in particular relations with Cambodia. So that's a possibility that relations could sour to some degree, that Cambodia is perceived as being associated with Thaksin himself. So that's a potential.
And, I guess this last question is asking you to look into your crystal ball a little. How do you see this conflict resolving? Is there a peaceful end in sight?
Well, there was an article earlier today from the Thai Development Research Institute, a suggestion by one of their people calling for sort of a drafting process for a new constitution whereby you elect drafters. So it's an election, but that the process would require a supermajority, so not quite consensus, but enough to represent the concerns of Bangkok and the South and make sure that whatever institutions were created had appropriate checks and balances. Some process like that whereby these two narratives could come together and get an elected government that treats people as citizens but has a minimal level of corruption. Hopefully is possible under some such system.
And that'll be the way forward.
Ideally, yes.
Thank you very much, Dr. Moore. I've been speaking to Dr. Joel Moore, political scientist from Monash University Sunway Campus. We've been discussing the political turmoil in Thailand on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.